Welcome to the Mug Meetings Summaries Podcast. I'm Gilbert Detilieu. Our November meeting started with the usual roundtable discussion, moderated by Sean Cody.
Or as a file system itself, or as a hidden file system on top of a container, every possible permutation. Just doing it as a file system or a file is good enough. If you're just trying to meet a compliance thing, then as a file system is more than adequate. The hidden file system stuff is just more paranoia safe. It doesn't really give you anything else that the other two options provide.
Security.
And TrueCrypt needs to be installed on all the machines.
It needs to be installed on machines that want to access the volume.
Yeah. And is this a driver?
It's usually a user-line application.
Oh, okay.
You can do portable TrueCrypt, but your mileage will vary on that. But it runs on everything. Yeah, I think you need elevated privileges if it's a file system, but if it's a container, it can be done in the user line, so it doesn't require special drivers.
Because by container, you mean like the TrueCrypt equivalent of a tar file?
Yeah.
Okay.
Just like a big binary image.
That's probably more compatible, because then a lot of the Arkham system comes off the file system.
Doing it as a file system makes more efficient use of the volume, like the disk, the space, but you lose the compatibility of copying the file or copying portions of it.
But what about files within the file? It's the equivalent of a big zip file, you say?
Yeah, essentially.
So to change
or an ISO
contents, copy things in and out of it?
You have to mount it. You have to mount it as a volume first, and then you can access it.
So when you mount it, you have to provide the password for the encryption code at the time of mounting?
Yeah, whatever method you chose on this key file, if it was passphrase or GSS stuff.
It's not really like a zip file, because you know, in a zip file, you can see the names of the files in it. The container is an encrypted copy of your file system. So once you get the unencryption in, it looks like a file system again. So now you can work with the individual files, delete them, add files, whatever. Right? So it's not quite like a zip file in that respect.
The best comparison is like a read-write ISO, like a CD image, right? It's not an actual CD, it's just a binary dump of the contents of it.
All right. I've been using Spam Assassin, among other things, for fighting spam on the mail server at work. And with an upgrade that came in mid-September to Spam Assassin, I've started getting false positives on a rule called Date in Future 96Q, which basically compares the date header against the closest received time. And if that difference between the dates is between 4 days and 4 months, it flags this rule. I'm getting false positives on that, where the difference between those is like a matter of seconds. And unfortunately, the score on that rule is very high, and it's caused some legit email to cross the threshold and be tagged as spam. I have not been able to find anything on Google searches of that showing anyone else having this problem. But we've been having it since Spam Assassin was upgraded in mid-September.
I'm getting a lot of positive hits on that. Mm-hmm. Some and a substantial portion of them are false positives. But every example that I've drilled down into has been somebody with an ancient system where they haven't updated the daylight savings time rules, mm-hmm. or someone whose clock is off by 12 hours, or something fairly straightforward like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, it does. That rule is causing a lot of false positives, but I've never seen it happen with just like seconds off.
Seconds off, and it's the same time zone in both the date and the received header? Yeah. Has anyone else come across this?
Does it only apply to certain MTAs?
That I don't know.
So I'm thinking if there was an MTA, like either a specific site or a specific version of an MTA that misformatted the date header somehow, maybe? That's all I can think of.
It's been happening to people in our department who are connecting through MTS and others that are on sabbatical in France and connecting through an ISP in France. I don't know whether there's any commonality between those two.
Could be.
I haven't checked details like what client are they using, what's the ISP using as the MTA.
That's what I was going to say.
Yeah, I could. I just started discovering these problems recently and went back through the logs and noticed, going back to early October at least, we've been getting these.
So you say an update in SPAM, you update the code or update to the set or something?
A package update.
So
code and rules and like a lot of stuff would have probably been upgraded. Yeah. But yeah, we had been using it for years without this being an issue, and it's just with this latest update.
You said late September-ish?
Mid-September, 14th actually.
What OS? CentOS?
It's CentOS 5 point, whatever the latest is, 5.6.
Yep. That was the upgrade from 0.94 to 0.95, which included a change in the rule syntax. So, yeah, it's like new code.
Well, it's Spam Assassin 3.3.1 actually.
Sorry, I'm thinking
Clam 331-2.el5.
Sorry, I'm thinking Clam AV, which also updated at almost the exact same time.
But it brings up a good point. I mean, if they did change the syntax or broke the ABI between, or the API between them and the rule sets, you have to make absolutely sure that they ship new rules. You didn't leave any of the old rules laying around because it may get confused by an old rule and make the wrong decisions.
I did scans for that particular tag for the rule through all of the Spam Assassin files, and I found it appears in the score file. It appears in one of the files that basically applies that rule, and then I found where in the code it actually does the checking. It's in a module called header-eval.pm. I looked through that code, and it looks like valid Perl code, but I didn't drill down all the way to see, you know, how it's actually parsing the headers and stuff like that. But
it is repeatable if you run that program, that email through the assessment is flagged again.
Oh yeah.
So it's consistent.
It's consistent. Yeah.
I'm thankful for that.
Dumb question maybe, but you are running SA update, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So it's not just like a one time bug in the rule that's been fixed since.
I don't think so.
Could you try hand modifying the message so the times match exactly and running it through again?
I did not try that. I think I will, just to see.
It's like, well, if the times match, maybe it's picking up on something else. Mm. Like maybe there's some other weird formatting you can throw it off.
Yeah. With the way the universe is going lately, it'll be a UTF-8 version of a colon.
Yeah. Making random changes. See what see what it finds.
Set list.
You're baiting. Sorry.
Now, is that anything else? Any other topic?
Actually, I've got a question since I'm supposed to be sort of managing some Solaris systems now, and I don't know much about it. I was just thinking about a network test I did today, and between two Solaris 10 servers, Sunfire V490s, and a TCP connection running the test TCP tool, claims that I'm getting it in, I guess, about 350, 400 megabits between two servers that are like connected to the same switch in the same VLAN and they're in the same rack. And I thought that was a bit low, but how much?
About
400 megabits on a gigabit.
What kind of switch? What brand?
Cisco.
They don't do wire speeds.
They don't do what?
Wire speed. It'll say gigabit, but they can't sustain it.
Which campus?
Cisco. Yeah.
Well, if there's only two ports talking, they can.
Maybe. Maybe.
Depends on the switch, yeah.
It's fully flexed.
What's the you actually run a file transfer or something like that?
The test TCP only transfers like a few megabytes at a time.
That is pretty much normal though for any OS combination that is using a standard untuned TCP stack.
Single stream as well.
Yeah. Run TTCP with -u, and there's some options that run it with UDP packets instead of TCP packets.
Yeah.
You have to like play around with the parameters, and it'll take you several test runs to get it just right, but I can almost guarantee that you'll see the UDP packets peaking at around 800 to 900 megabits. Mm. But yeah, what you're seeing is characteristic of TCP on a gigabit network.
Because I have a gigabit network at home, and between a Linux box and my iMac wired, it's getting more like 900.
Yeah, well, your Linux box doesn't use the standard Reno congestion control algorithms anymore. And if I'm not mistaken, Macs open a much larger initial window size now. You can tune these parameters in Solaris too.
Yeah.
Actually, if you Google Google breaks TCP, you'll actually find some papers documenting what Google does to ignore the window size negotiation. And if you actually implement that on your local network. I'm going to verify. Apparently, you got the Google search correct. basically, by tweaking the initial window size and forcing it to assume that the peer can accept a large window size, basically you ignore slow start.
Yeah, I thought I read about that not too long ago. And I thought it was just for their homepage, like Google.com.
Yes. Yeah, that's what Google's using it for.
Yeah.
My point is that on a local LAN where you know the environment and you can control the environment, turning off slow start will, maybe not dramatically, but noticeably increase TCP performance. So will switching to, for example, one of the bicubic style congestion control algorithms. If you're running Linux, it's trivial. I have no idea how you do it on Solaris. And like I said, just fiddling with the window sizes, initial window size, maximum segment size and maximum window size on Solaris will make a huge difference.
The other thing you can do on Solaris, if your NICs are capable of it, is turn on jumbo frames.
Right.
Because
yeah,
it cuts a lot of the overhead, the fragmentation overhead.
Yeah.
But going back to your Cisco switch comment.
If your switch is capable too, right. Everyone along the way has got to be capable of it.
The other
thing you might Google that we played with on Solaris and we have problems with, depending on your NIX, is something that's called Nagel's algorithm.
Oh, yeah.
N-A-G-L-E.
Yeah, I've heard of that.
Yeah, that's another thing that can stand some tweaking too if you really want to get the maximum performance.
That's just for short files though, right?
Yeah, if you know how it's based up. The thing it is with your home switch, the Cisco will probably maintain that speed with a lot of other stuff on the ports.
Yeah.
At your home switch, when you get that 800 or 900, fire up another 300 on another port, and watch what happens. it's kind of spread out.
I wasn't too concerned about that happening at home.
Yeah, but I mean, that's the difference with Cisco. It may not on one port, but it'll be pretty consistent across all the ports.
Yeah, I don't know how busy that switch is.
And, you know, we're getting wire speed off Juniper networks, the shameless plugs. Juniper switches.
Yeah, that requires dealing with your salespeople.
It's running full duplex too. If you haven't messed up
good gear,
that's what my manager.
Well, yeah, that was the other thing. Thought I would check. Do you know how to change the duplex setting on
NDD? Is your friend
on Solaris?
On Solaris NDD.
NDD.
Yeah, man NDD.
Really matter?
Yes, it does.
Ether doesn't. In the spec, doesn't have duplex. It always assumes full.
Yeah, but Cisco and Solaris still don't always play nice, even with gig auto negotiation. One of them did not implement .1z perfectly in the initial round. Yeah, actually, that that's a good point. If it's an older Cisco gigabit switch, that could be a problem to auto negotiation. Because Solaris and Cisco switches were infamous for not auto negotiating back in the Ethernet days, sorry, in the 100 megabit Ethernet days. And some of the very earliest Cisco gigabit capable switches carried over, and they still didn't do .1z correctly.
Yeah, I'd heard that a while back, just not even with Solaris, that there was a lot of stuff that didn't work with auto. So a lot of our stuff at the city is set to 100 full.
Yeah.
It's just,
and that's why. Because
because they said, oh, yeah, it's a problem. It's like, well, I've never seen this problem. So I was setting it back to auto. Because
it was in this in the original spec for auto negotiation, there was a slight ambiguity.
Right.
Cisco interpreted it this way. The rest of the universe interpreted it that way.
Ideal example of Moore's Law. If there's more than one way to do it, someone sometime will do it the wrong way.
Yeah.
I'll just echo the one side is really pretty much a problem issue.
Fiddling too much on multiple streams.
Yeah.
If you're not getting higher than that on multiple streams, then the limits of the tuning.
Yeah, good point.
I will play that a little bit, but most of the time the tuning just makes other things worse. Like disabling Kinagle would screw up a lot of low bandwidth, high time, high duration connections.
Are they close enough to use
Yeah, there's all kinds of dumb options you can set, but most of the time TCP isn't really meant to do like one stream, huge amount of traffic.
Yeah.
But it's like 300 is reasonable
for
one stream.
Yeah.
If you run 2 and you're not seeing much better than 300, then you know you have a 2 or a bus issue.
That's not in a 490.
I don't know what the bus is in a 490.
Well, just about every slot has its own dedicated bus.
Oh, really?
That's insane. Well, insane relative to the CPU they put in it anyway.
Okay. Well, we'll look into some of those things.
Yeah, that's a good point. Just run 2 goblins in parallel first.
Yeah. Well, I'm working on those. The same Never mind. No, I'm not going to get into that.
Oh, you're writing an iSCSI?
No. 2 gigabit fiber channel.
Don't worry about the standards.
Well,
unless you have proof that it's broken.
Functionally, it works, but performance is pretty low.
It's a SAN.
That has more to do with LUN configuration or anything else.
Or there's a vendor sometimes.
Cool.
Hey.
That one's fun. Anyone got anything similar?
Actually, I have this problem at home, but I've had it from several of my friends. And it's an NTFS partition that Windows XP will not recognize anymore. And what can I do to try and retrieve data? Or am I totally dreaming? I think you're having checked it. Yes. That was after check, you said I didn't recognize it.
There's a program that I used to use, or I still do use. It's called Get Data Back. I'm pretty sure it's a Get My Data Back or something along the line. They make one for FAT, and they make one for GFS. And it'll basically go in there for individual files sometimes, or try and find the boundaries of partition.
Because I've gone out and I've looked at the various tools on the system, mostly the CPU, and it's one of those things that, being kind of new to it, the more I read, the more confused I got. So I figured I'd ask if anybody had any
Windows. You tried it off on Windows?
Yeah, it did work.
Oh, Windows won't work, then.
That's what I'm saying. It was a disk with 3 partitions on it. It was going along beautifully.
Oh,
and then, like I said, one day after, a check disk, because it was reporting some lines of errors, that's when it came up in that partition. You know, it just won't recognize it. Yes? Who, what?
Yeah, I've used Get Data Back on a busted flash drive. It wouldn't show anything at all. It was fat partition. Cost $60, I think. But it's well worth it. It just sort of dragged the whole thing back. I don't know how it would work on that, but that's at least a little bit of an endorsement for that particular product.
I was just going to say the same thing. There's dozens upon dozens of Windows data recovery utilities, many of them let you create a bootable ISO image. So if you need to do it on a system that's completely dead, you just boot off CD, and they'll go through the file system, and they're, when I say dozens and dozens, there's only about half a dozen different utilities. The rest are all just licensees and rebranding of those half dozen core utilities, and sold for 10 times the price of the original. So, but I've had pretty good luck with all of them. Shoot, who's the guys in Toronto with the Clean Lab? There's a data recovery company. They've got offices in Toronto and offices in Minneapolis, and I am completely drawing a blank on their name. But they sponsored the development of one of these, and I mean, it's professional grade. So if you need the heavy artillery, yeah, you pay the $60 or $80 for theirs. Otherwise, you go look at the websites and look at the one that just looks like click, 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 dot. And they pretty much all do as advertised.
Does the drive feel fine? Okay. Put your finger on the drive while it's spinning?
I didn't open the machine.
Oh, okay. Well, that's one of the things, like, if you can't be read, if you feel like, if it's running, it'll just be a constant vibration. If there are physical problems, there'll be periods in the vibration. So there'll be like little gaps, and then you know that you've got a much different problem on your hands.
That would affect all partitions.
If it's really bad, you're late and you don't know exactly how it got in that state, the very first thing you want to do is bit by bit copy
that. That was my second.
And do not try recovery when that drive's failing. You only want to get somebody to fix that. And every time you fix it, you want to
just screech.
Right. So if it's really valuable, copy it off once, set it on the shelf.
Throw it in the freezer.
This outfit Adam's talking about.
On track. I just remembered it.
Well, like you said, the where it stands right now is I was doing regular backups, and it was between the backups that we lost. So what I'm really looking at is the data is not super critical that we get it back, but I figured while I have this happening, I would like to try and get some experience. Like I said, I went online and I was reading about a whole bunch of stuff, and after a while it just started to swing in front of my face. Where do you go?
Well, so. any form of data recovery, the first thing is clone. Never work on the original. Like, clone the device.
Yes, right.
If you can't clone the device, you know you have a physical issue.
Yeah,
there are other tools that do it at the firmware level, like SpinWrite. If the drive is not too new, SpinWrite will do wonders. Especially for like small sectors at the beginning of the disk that your BIOS just can't get past. It'll just mark them as clean and move it, so that it's not going through the BIOS anymore, and then you can recover it, throw the disk out. But like any form of repair, never use the original media to try to recover it. Always do a bit by bit copy. If you can't get that far, it's time to send it to pros. After that, you do all kinds of fun stuff, like recovering ray arrays, which is an application for the pigeonhole problem. But that's fun.
You shouldn't trust that disk, right?
No.
So the disk should be replaced anyway.
Yeah.
I just figured while I had this real-life experience, I'd have a go at it.
Well, it's totally worthwhile.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
That's the other advantage of making that bitwise copy, is anything you do to destroy the copy, who cares?
Yeah.
Right.
We'll get that.
Cool.
I had a chance recently, very recently, to experiment a little bit with Fedora 16. Official release date was just today, but I had it in my hands yesterday. One of the privileges of running a mirror site. Anyway, this is it on the screen here, running on my little ThinkPad X120E here. In general, it seems very nice. It's running the Linux 3.0 kernel, so I wouldn't put it on a production system just yet.
Is it 3.0 or 3.1?
Good question.
I thought I read something today from about Fedora 16 that said 3.1.
Yeah, you're right. 3.1.0. Yeah. I stand corrected. Nice thing on this laptop, I was running Fedora 14 on here prior to doing this upgrade. And this was fairly new hardware for Fedora 14. It didn't quite handle the graphics chipset properly, and the wireless was just not working, and I couldn't get that to work. I just did the upgrade, and lo and behold, both of them are working fine. So yeah, the graphics were fine, and I was really surprised that the wireless, I didn't have to even configure anything. It just did everything correctly. So yeah, that was nice. I also set it up on a server system to play around with it there, and this is in an NIS NFS environment. I ran into a few snags that way. One of them is actually a known bug that there was in Fedora 15, which was supposed to be fixed but didn't get fixed in Fedora 16. But there's a proposed solution which some people on the Bugzilla log said worked, and other people said it didn't work. And because it's a race condition, oh. I'm not sure if it works. I implemented the fix, and it seemed to work, but I don't know if this is a guaranteed fix. But the problem is that AutoFS will sometimes start before YPBind is ready, and so you don't get your NIS exported mount points. So you then have to restart AutoFS when that problem occurs. So, yeah, it turns out there's a configuration fix you can do that makes AutoFS wait for YPBind, but I'm not sure if it works or not. So anyway, that was one NIS-related gotcha that I was able to do something about. I ran into another NIS-related problem, though, and that one I wasn't even able to find anything on Google searches or on Bugzilla at Red Hat's site or anywhere. The problem seems to be anytime it does get group list thing, like through the set groups call or something, to generate the list of supplementary groups, like SSH would do this, SU would do this, anything that logs you in. But even when you run the groups command just to determine the list of groups for a particular user, it ignores the NIS groups. And it's not that NIS isn't working. Like, I can do all of the NIS stuff. I can log in using NIS accounts, and I get my primary group. The ID to name mappings are working even. So all of the NIS support should be working, but it seems that the get group list stuff doesn't bother consulting NIS to get the group, the secondary groups, supplementary groups. So all you get is your primary group when you log in, which is a bit of a pain. So if anyone comes across a fix for that, I would be quite interested, because I haven't been able to find anything yet.
Can you type ifconfig? I'm just curious to see what your interfaces look like now.
Oh, yeah, right.
WLAN 0, what is your wired one? I don't know. Then. Oh.
Still E0. ETH0. Yeah, on the server system, it wasn't ETH0, though. It was EM1 through EM4. It didn't even start at 0. It was 1 through 4. And there was another system that I was looking at where it had different IDs again. Wait a minute. It was this system. I'm not sure why it's coming up as F0 now when I first installed it. Oh, it was the installer showed it with a different ID. Yeah. Yeah, it's F0 now. But under the installer, it was showing with a different ID. I can't remember what it was, but I think it was like a two-letter code, a hyphen, and then some other code.
Did you do a fresh install or an upgrade?
Upgrade.
Oh, so you maybe that's configuration from
could
builder.
Be. Okay. Yeah, so it's doing the mapping somehow.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, good news is that means mapping is possible.
Yeah, that means it works.
Mm.
Yay. Okay, I've got a question. Ubuntu 11.10. Has anybody ever tried installing it with the swap partition as the first partition on the disk, not the second partition on the disk?
Yep.
Okay.
Actually, we're on the machine that shows
Okay.
How about a week or two ago?
Okay. I'm just found that that combination, it hangs on boot for me. Like my first partition is swap, my second partition is ext4, they're both primary partitions. That's it.
I've always done it that way, I was using boot first, then everything else secondary.
I've got swap first, then boot. Swap and root, that's it.
Swap first.
I don't see why it wouldn't work.
It should work. It used to work. So, I don't know.
Talking about Ubuntu 11.10, has anybody done an upgrade in place of 11.4 to 11.10?
Yeah, I did.
It worked. I haven't noticed. I still haven't got a system that works for it.
Oh, yeah. It worked perfectly for me.
The classic one. Unity works for me, but classic mode.
Yeah, it just worked. It behaved like it was supposed to for me. That was the
I had to install classic because it wasn't in there.
It goes through and update, install it, and then change it over.
But now my panels don't work.
One of my colleagues had a very interesting 1104 to 1110 experience. What happened to him was on 1104, he had to use the proprietary NVIDIA drivers to get his full screen res on his laptop, and he was running 64-bit Ubuntu, and so who knows how well they're supporting that, the proprietary driver, because when he upgraded it, his display was weird, let's say that. So the thing that actually made things work was removing the proprietary drivers and the newer version of the new Vo driver, the free software driver for NVIDIA stuff. It actually it worked in the newer version. It had this full resolution. And was glad to be rid of the NVIDIA software.
Well, actually, I just installed the driver on 64-bit to Ubuntu 11.10, and it works fine on the NVIDIA 11.1.
Yeah.
It was a brand new installation, but not upgrading.
Yeah, it did work for my friend. So his solution was actually removing the proprietary software, and Nuvo actually was actually better than the proprietary one in his case. And also, he was just glad to have it. Our company is supposed to be doing all free software after all.
Just a note, actually. Actually, I had a meeting last week. Bill was presiding over the meeting there. It was the Asterisk group, which is more or less a different name now. But there was an interesting thing, that discussion that came up that Lesson started out, and that was with the Rainy Day guy. What's his name?
Jeff Klaus.
Jeff Klaus. Yeah. Right. But they're actually starting up a Winnipeg-based Manitoba, it's called Manitoba Internet Exchange. I guess it'll be hosted out someplace down by Gray Exchange, I think it is.
Walmart, yeah.
Yeah. So they're actually getting a bunch of the ISPs together and doing a lot of peering. So
are they going to call it Manix for short?
Was it NBIX? Yes. Was it NBIX or something? Or NBIX?
Yeah, that wouldn't be about NBIX. I just called the Manitoba Internet Exchange. Yeah. Good point. Max, I think we should not have.
Oh, well, we had to read in what the press called that.
Yeah.
Or something.
Like, well, minutes.
Anyway, that was an interesting thing that's come out. Looks like we could have some interesting possibilities for a couple of Russian minutes.
Go ahead. I have a problem, actually, with just recently, a couple of days ago, I was unable to view some websites, and I was unsure why. I did some digging around, and it turns out some people changed their MTU to 1492. I did that, and all of a sudden I can view these sites. What changed? No GSL.
What do you use? GSL cable?
Cable.
Yeah. Really?
My first thought was my router died again. I seem to go through a Linksys router once a year.
14. That shouldn't make any difference on cable. Like, no. Because the cable network is just
1500.
It's a 1500 frame relay. Right? Mm-hmm. So 1492 would make sense if you're doing some kind of like TPP. Or there's some encapsulation on top of that. But SHA isn't doing any encapsulation as far as I know. They've just set aside a bunch of signal for raw Ethernet frames on a hub, essentially. And it's just 1492.
Yeah, I can view the sites now. I was trying to actually post to one of them, through Pastebin, but it didn't work.
Well, but what do you have before that?
It was automatic, so it would have been 1500.
Really?
Okay.
But were you saying that you had heard something about these other sites? Like, how?
What do you mean? Like, the sites I'm going to is just like Wikipedia or Arch.
Okay, so stuff that should have been good.
Yeah, the sites are, they should be fine, but I couldn't view them. My Windows machine can do it just fine on the same network, so I'm trying to determine what changed or what's broken,
I'm thinking you might want to replace your Linksys router anyway.
Yeah, it might be time to do.
Yeah, I'm not using a VLAN for tagging, something like that.
No.
Is there a specific site code browser?
No, like, for example, Lighting. HTTP, like their site, is perfectly legit. Everybody can view it, and I can't.
Are you using any packet filter on your house at all?
I have IP tables on the machine, but it's not configured.
Is it on?
Might be.
Default configuration might disable fragmentation.
Mm.
So setting it to 14, it might be fragmenting for no apparent reason. Mm. But if it sees something that's fragmented, it won't reassemble it. So, but I don't. Something
actually,
I would think.
Most Linksys routers default to drop EDFs.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. So it's not bad then.
Well, no, that still could be.
That should take care of it.
Wireshark something on that interface to see what the protocol changes are playing with. The question is it TCP? Is that the TCP layer? It sounds like you're suggesting it is. So
yeah.
Is it at the HTTP? No, is that the
Yeah.
What layer are we talking about?
It's just websites that you can issue?
Yes.
You can still
send
trace
route application.
That's
fine. Do you have access to a host on the internet when you're shuttle? Okay, try doing a ping and then set the packet size to 1500 and then decrement by one until you start getting responses back. Because that will tell you if it's application layer or if it's ICANN layer or TCP.
You could also try Firefox, you could try Google.
Yeah, Firefox. I'm using Chromium. Firefox works. Firefox wasn't working by the time.
Was Chrome working?
Yeah, no. No
browser
was working. No.
But go by hand.
I should try that.
I'll show you how to do that.
So like 3 minutes.
Yeah.
Was this over several days, or was it just during a short period of time?
This was in the past 3 days. It just happened. I didn't do any package updates. I didn't really change anything at all.
Because I had a period of time 3 weeks ago where I had several of the major websites that I couldn't get on for a 2-day period.
Yeah.
And then it just fixed itself.
Whether
it was a bad router? It was Shaw. Sure
I had a problem with sending email. You send an email, it would just
bounce.
It would take minutes to send it. Then I phoned Shaw Temple's board. They said, "Oh, that's no problem. Must be your browser, your mail client." But I didn't change a thing.
See, Shaw's.
And then 2 days later, it all started to work, and I had no problems. I didn't change anything.
Shaw moved everybody to digital at the beginning of September. All the TV subscribers, everybody had to go to digital and get digital boxes. And they have been screwing around with a lot of the stuff. Now, I assumed it was just the TV signal that was getting screwed around. They could be playing around with the internet signal as well.
I'm pretty sure my parents don't have a box. You said that it works fine in Windows. Is that a separate machine?
Yes.
Kevin?
Swap the cables.
Yeah.
No, I'm serious.
Yeah.
If you've got one bad pair, Windows is a little bit more resilient with bad hardware. So if you've got a bad cable, that would be a good reason why. That's
weird.
That's the entire
or
stack.
The port.
Hardware, all the way to application.
When I've had issues in the past with the Linksys routers where if I had to switch in between my computer and the router, I would lose my IP address in 24 hours.
Yeah.
No idea why.
That's just DHCP.
And
your lease expires. You just can't get a new one.
I just chucked the router and it didn't work.
Not porting ARP properly?
Or the port on the Linksys router just died spontaneously.
Sure.
What Sean was saying about cables, too, make sure your cables aren't tied around electrical cords and stuff like
maybe
that.
Maybe that's why there's so many routers.
Bad power.
I mean,
cabling counts for a lot.
Cabling's pretty cool.
Not that
yeah, no, and they're nasty, too. 10x T is pretty tolerant.
It is.
Yeah.
Tolerant to electrical.
It depends on whether it's a broad cable or a home.
Possibly,
you can't believe on that as much.
remember when they first came out with 10BASE-T, and the demo had the cable going from the computer up wrapped around fluorescent around an AC motor, and they said, like, this cable is very insensitive to electromagnetic radiation. It wasn't gigabit, it was only
if they're going to wrap around a light, they should have used fiber optic instead.
Watch that.
Watch the radius.
Bring a protractor at every turn.
Question actually on the emails. With the MTS people, do they actually limit the number of outgoing SMTPs that you're about to do per hour? Is there a restriction on this in terms of quantity?
They are if you're SJR on a Tuesday.
Sorry?
They are if you're SJR on a Tuesday. It's when our mail, don't mail anything on Tuesday, it's when our mail outs all go. They throttle us back, oh yeah.
It's quite likely that they've had to start implementing those controls by now, yeah. I don't know for sure, but I know I just implemented outbound rate control for the ISP I work with, because we have too many people who just, you know, actually answer the emails asking for their username and password. So, you know, you got a dozen people with compromised accounts. They've authenticated to your mail server, so they're allowed to send and just blast out one email per second all day long. And, gee, what a surprise, we're blacklisted again.
So what's the current, is there an actual limit that they do this for on an hourly or daily
basis? I don't know what the exact limit is.
It'll be arbitrary.
Oh, yeah.
It's MTS, it'll be arbitrary.
MTS's email is all taken care of now by Microsoft.
Yeah, you're talking Microsoft Live or the business class?
Personal home.
Personal, so you're much the Microsoft.
It's going to be Microsoft servers.
Well, this is actually a friend's business that's running off of MTS DSL home service, right?
Yeah.
And they're sending emails out to their clients.
What are they using as their?
What's your next hop?
Yeah. I don't know.
Like if their SMTP service, SMTP.MTS.net, there could very well be limited.
Do they actually allow anything to go through them?
It's SMTPlive.com.
Yeah, that's
Microsoft.
Yeah. Well, that's the one they want you to switch to. And they have weird laws, so I'm actually basically moving all my personal stuff away and just leaving it as the business that they put in to get blocking my account. And I don't send that many.
ISP's in danger for more than 10 years.
I have a friend that does house concerts, and he found when he switched to the new MTS Live that when he sent out his email to 200 people on the list announcing the house concert coming up.
Yeah.
It blocked him because he would send out too many on a day. So he found that he had to take his list, cut it in half, and send it out
groups
on different days.
But you mean on the same day?
Yeah.
You're joking. I thought you were in a different relay or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyone want the email account? If you have a Gmail account, pump it through that. OpenSMTPD is actually really simple. I found that out because I needed. Rogers decided to stop being nice with their relay on their 3G service, so I had to make my own exchanger. And it only took me 10 minutes with OpenSMTP. I was absolutely floored. I didn't have to do anything.
What is OpenSMTP? Is that a site?
No, it's a daemon, sort of like OpenBGPD. Basically, they take a daemon that doesn't work very well, the OpenBSD project, and then just says, okay, we'll do it a different way. And it's on track to replace SendMail in base.
Really?
Very soon, yeah. It's really slick. It's very simple to configure. There's no...
That's not saying much.
well, compared to
SendMail is like, Lord.
The syntax is more like PF than it is like SendMail, right? So it's English, and...
Sort of.
It's rather straightforward. Like, for an exchanger that just relays to another site, just to do off was three lines of configuration. Mm-hmm. I was floored by it.
Speaking from the ISP's perspective, not MTS, ISP-hosted email is, how can I phrase this, VHS tapes. If you want to use email for a business, get the hell off your ISP's mail server in all ways, shapes, and forms.
no ISP wants to run an email server anymore because it's increasingly, like, the spam problem alone is massive. For any decent-sized ISP, that's consuming minimum of one full-time person all day, every day, for what is essentially a zero-revenue service.
It's free service.
Yeah. And with guys like Google allowing free usage of Google Mail for businesses, you can have your own domain, you can do everything you want with their service. It's kind of like, why are we still in this business? And like MTS, the smtp.mts.net is still reachable from some DSL connections, but not others. From depending on where in the city you are and which DSLAM you're connected to and what IP range your address is in, you may not be able to connect to it at all.
Cool. Well, I guess we'll have to leave it at that.
Oh, yeah.
3 minutes over.
Okay. That's it for this podcast. Thanks for listening. For more MUG meetings summaries or for more information about the Manitoba Unix User Group, check out our website at muug.mb.ca.